This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Liza Long is the mother of a child who has bipolar disorder. When she heard about the school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, her first thought was, what if my son does that someday? She wrote an emotional response to the tragedy, which was published online as I Am Adam Lanz's Mother. Since then, she's continued to write both online and in print, including her book, The Price of Silence, A Mom's Perspective on Mental Illness. As a mental health advocate, she challenges the flaws in today's mental health care system, works to end the stigma that surrounds mental health issues, and provides her perspective as a parent of a child with a serious mental illness. She joins us to share her experiences and talk about the current state of mental health care. Liza, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. It's a really important subject.
Yes, it is. And tell us about the day that you wrote the blog. You were worried that what Adam Lanza did, that could be your son someday. What other things were going through your mind as you wrote this?
That morning, I got into work and I heard the news about Newtown, and I just closed the door to my office, put my head on my desk, and started to cry. Because at that point, my very personal tragedy with my son intersected with a very public tragedy. And I think it's such a shame that the only time we really do have conversations about mental illness is when a very rare outlier event like the Newtown shootings occurs. But for me, it was just literally a breaking point. I'd been essentially in hiding as a parent of a child with a then undiagnosed mental illness. And my son at that very moment was in an acute care psychiatric hospital, and he was threatening revenge on me when he got out for putting him in there. We did not know what was wrong. I had tried for almost 10 years to get help for my child. And, you know, I think it's unacceptable in a healthcare system that a parent should take a child to a doctor and say, I need help, and 10 years later still not have access to the right diagnosis, the right treatments. My big push has been treatment before tragedy. And that day, I sat down and wrote my truth and my family's truth. And obviously, I didn't think I would be talking to you in Cincinnati or in the other places I've had chances to speak about my family's experiences. I was telling my own community. I'm an educator here. I'm active in the local community. And I had not ever felt safe, in, even with some of my closest friends, sharing my family's struggles. And so I did. I wrote my truth. Boise State University's online journal picked it up, asked if I would publish it. The editor's a good friend of mine. And we had a really tough conversation about whether I should put my name on the story. And in the end, Nate convinced me that was the right thing to do, to put my name on the story. He said, until people put their names on these stories, it's not real.
Now, when you wrote your blog post, what kind of a reaction did you get to it?
Well, it was a shocking reaction. I mean, I think we all know that nobody reads your blog, right? That's kind of the joke.
Nobody at least that's what we think. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, and I blogged anonymously, like a lot of mental illness bloggers, because it was an uncomfortable subject to talk about at that time. And I think, you know, the reaction, I don't even know how to explain what it's like to see something go viral. I remember that night I looked at my partner and my son, and I said, we're going to turn off our phones, we're going to turn off all the computers, and tomorrow things might be a little different. And they were. They were a little different.
Well, what kind of impact did that have on you and your family, writing that blog?
You know, in some ways, it had both, like anything, it had unintended consequences, both negative and positive. The largest positive consequence was that by sharing my story, my son actually was diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
Wow.
I gave such a specific description of his symptoms in the blog that a national expert actually contacted me and said, I know what your son has. And we were able to see him. My son was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. That was 2 years ago. Since that was his last hospitalization, he has not been back to juvenile detention. He's had no threats of harm to self or others in those 2 years, just since the diagnosis, starting to take lithium. And of course, we can't just cure mental illness with medication. We also have to have a slew of ancillary services to help kids and their families. But, you know, that was an overwhelming positive that my son was diagnosed and treated. And it's been life-changing for my family. Some of the negative consequences, though, were that a judge in Idaho actually removed my two younger children from my home because he said they weren't safe. And this was especially frustrating because every parent who has a child with violent tendencies or violent behavioral issues has to have a family safety plan. And my family did. And we had worked on that plan with the Department of Health and Welfare in my state, with input from the police, with input from Child Protection Services. And so the fact that a judge could come in and do that to me anyway, when I had a safety plan, when I was doing everything right, is truly terrifying. And even to this day, Mark, when moms say, well, should I share my story too? I say, think it through. You may face some consequences that you can't even begin to imagine. In the end, I was able to get my younger two children back, and things were okay. But I really would not have put my name on the story if I had thought that was a consequence that could have happened.
But did you hear from others, Liza, who said, you're exactly right. I'm so glad that you spoke out about this.
That was the most amazing thing for me, Mark, is the groundswell. When I wrote those words, I thought I was the only mom in America who felt the way I did. And instead, I was overwhelmed with the response. I'm Adam Lanza's mother, too. I'm Adam Lanza's dad. I'm his teacher. I'm his psychiatrist. I'm his therapist. And to see that, you know, to free that groundswell of emotion and, that call for change and support and help and I don't know what to do, that's really why I wrote my book, The Price of Silence, because so many people suddenly turned to me and said, well, what do we do? And I said, I don't know. I think we need to figure it out. And so in my book, I looked at all of the various systems that parents of a child with mental illness have to navigate, and they're complicated systems. And I think even in the Connecticut Child Advocate Report, it does a great job of showing how the Lanzas, like many families, saw early warning signs and did try to get help, and repeatedly the system failed them.
You know, there's a picture of your son on your post when he was younger, and it's just such a beautiful picture. And I can't imagine, Liza, how tough it's been dealing with an illness that causes an otherwise sweet, intelligent child to go into these bursts of anger and rage. And you say it took 10 years before he was finally diagnosed as being bipolar?
Yes, 10 years.
That had to be hugely frustrating to get that diagnosis correct. I just can't imagine what that was like.
Well, yeah, and that's the frustration is, we're still in some ways in the dark ages with diagnosis and treatment, and we're even really fighting about what mental illness is. We're having that very public fight. Do people have a right to refuse treatment, for example? And the frustration for me is that I saw my son's illness very early on as a brain disease, just like some children have cancer or some people have diabetes. That's what I saw with my son. He was not his illness. He had an illness. And to not have a name for it or a treatment for it or a plan, like my experience is similar to many parents. The first thing they do is look at the parents and blame the parents and say, well, you just need to take parenting classes. I am a big fan of parenting classes, by the way. I love Love and Logic. I've taken it many times, and it has really helped me with my other three neurotypical children, but it doesn't do anything when my son escalates to a manic rage. Nothing. There's no logic there. That's just a safety plan at that point. And the biggest frustration is to see your child suffering, because he's just an awesome kid. He's smart, and he's funny, and just a really great kid, and he doesn't want to have those rages. I could see that so clearly. He didn't want that to happen. When he'd come out of them, he wouldn't even remember. And, he would just be so remorseful as he'd see the damage that he'd done. And it's just really painful as a parent to not be able to help your child. I think there's nothing worse in the world than not being able to help your child.
What were some of the initial recommendations that you got, Liza, for dealing with your son's illness and the violence it was causing?
Well, our experiences were pretty similar to what a lot of parents go through. Initially, we had sought help while he was in preschool, and we'd had evaluations, and the thought at first was that he was on the autism spectrum, and that came up several times throughout the course of his care that, well, maybe this is an autism spectrum disorder. By the time he was 5 years old and in kindergarten, they actually had a clear the room plan in place in case he did have an explosive meltdown. So this is a five-year-old, you know, and they have a plan to get the children out of the building. And we knew at that point that we had some problems. But the diagnosis process, it almost felt like a roulette wheel or, you know, Ouija board. You know, you'd go to one doctor and it's like, well, yeah, it's autism spectrum. And another doctor would say, oh, it's not that at all. It's oppositional defiant disorder. And we had that diagnosis, intermittent explosive disorder, ADHD at one point. So it's a really frustrating process because, you know, the care and the treatment for each of those conditions can be very different. And even with the medications, you know, that was really frustrating for me because with mental illness, if you have bipolar disorder, for example, some medications may not work and may actually be harmful. And that's the case with a lot of illness. So the fact that we can't pinpoint that we don't have like a blood test, for example, right, that says, oh, yes, this is what you have, it can be really frustrating.
Didn't somebody recommend incarceration as a possibility to you?
Oh, no, my son has been in juvenile detention
yes.
four times.
Yes.
He was in four times before he turned 13. And
yeah.
this, to me, is the most frustrating thing about mental illness. You know, it's kind of
It seems
of
like it's a common pathway.
Oh, yes, yes. And people didn't want to believe me. I wrote about that in my blog and a whole chapter in my book. People don't want to believe that we've chosen as a society to treat adults and children who have mental illness by sending them to jail. But that is, in fact, what we're doing. You know, the largest mental health treatment facilities in the United States today are still Rikers Island County Jail and the Los Angeles County Jail. And people just don't want to believe that that happens, not just with adults, but also with children. And there's a little girl right now, Morgan Geyser, who has schizophrenia, and she's being charged as an adult in the Slender Man case. She has schizophrenia, and she's in jail. You know, it's just kind of baffling to me. My own son, that was absolutely our experience in our state. At that time, to get access to some really needed services, your child actually had to be within the court system. And so, yes, it was recommended several times. In fact, at the time of the Newtown shootings, I'd just gotten off the phone with my son's social worker who said, well, you probably should charge him with battery so that we can get him back in the system. I'm thinking that sounds like a great treatment option. Let's get him back in the juvenile justice system because, you know, what's the logical consequence of that as a society? You know, it's a really expensive way to manage an illness, right?
Yes.
To send kids to jail and then it becomes a cycle and then homelessness and all of this. And instead, they could be productive members of society. It's so frustrating to me.
Liza, do we have any idea how many children in the U.S. are suffering from mental illness?
If you look at the National Institute of Mental Health, that's a great place to get up-to-date statistics about mental illness and the various types. So right now it's about 1 in 5, which is a huge number if you think about it. That means if it's not your child, it's five children in your child's classroom, right? And that's throughout the lifespan. 1 in 5 children will have a serious and debilitating mental disorder. That's huge, you know, and within the adult population, we know that as many as 1 in 4 people will suffer some kind of mental health care crisis or issue. But with serious mental illness, like bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, what my son has, that's a smaller portion of the population. That's just about 4% of the population. However, that population is disproportionately affected by things like prison and the school-to-prison pipeline.
You know, when we're having conversations about mental illness, what do you think of the word recovery?
yeah. Well, I have to say, I don't like the word, especially not for serious mental illness. And I wrote a blog post on Huffington Post a while ago where I said, you know, I feel like the word itself can be stigmatizing because what it does is it gives us this sense that, you know, we don't say that with cancer, for example, right? We don't say, well, you're in recovery for the rest of your life with cancer. We say you're in remission, mm-hmm. right? And what's really been helpful both for my son and for myself to understand his bipolar disorder is to really look at it as a chronic, lifelong thing, difference, he likes to say, chronic lifelong difference that he's going to have to manage with medication, with supports, with therapy. And when we have that mindset, it just seems so much more manageable, as opposed to the idea that, oh, you need to recover from your mental illness. Like it just seems like it's making it seem like mental illness is a choice. And it's not. It's not a choice. It's a brain disease.
Liza, when it comes to the way we're dealing with mental illness in the U.S., what are some of the other areas where we're going wrong?
Well, school. We could definitely start with school. And again, this was something, even though I was living the school-to-prison pipeline with my own child, I was shocked when I got in and looked at the research and saw just how completely well-intentioned policies, zero-tolerance policies that started to be put in place after Columbine, you know, everyone can understand that's a well-intentioned policy. But again, unintended consequences were that children who had developmental disabilities and also mental illness were being increasingly funneled into prison. And the consequences for our society with that, I think, are extreme now and are going to become more extreme as more and more children move through that system. So for me, there's a couple of places where we could make some simple changes that could have a lot of impact. And the first place would be with early intervention. So better training for pediatricians. You know, my own son's doctor, like I said, I knew something was wrong when he was very young. And she said, oh, he's just a boy. And I thought, well, my older son's just a boy too, but
he didn't have these problems.
Explosive rages, right? You know, I'm like, yeah, but that's a really common thing too. So if we had pediatricians with better training, so we could catch things earlier and put supports in place for families. Another elephant in the room with children's mental illness is poverty, and I think as a country we have got to talk about poverty and the stress of childhood trauma that creates. So, you know, looking at better support systems early on for families, it would just pay dividends. It would pay so many dividends in the future. And that would be huge for me. Another, I talked about the schools. School is a great place to attack this problem because we already have the infrastructure. You know, imagine that you had a school with a day that matched the work day, right? So because like I was managing my child's illness as a single mother. And when you have a child with a complicated medical condition, you could spend 10 to 20 hours a week just driving your child around to various appointments. And I used to say that to myself. I'd say, you know, how am I supposed to work and feed my family and take care of my other children and manage this illness just in 24 hours a day? It's not.
Oh, the stress is incredible.
Yeah, it's like you're set up for failure, and so is your child in that kind of situation. So going back to the school model, what if you had a school that matched the workday and you brought the service providers there to the school? Let's say you had two relaxation rooms where children could go. Don't make them stigmatizing, you know, like make it a reward for kids, but also, you know, a timeout place for children like my son who have these sensory issues or who need a place to go so that they don't have these meltdowns. So have those dedicated rooms, you know, put a big swing in there. The kids love the big swings, you know, something like that. And then bring the service providers there to the school. So bring in the psychiatrist, bring in the probation officers, you know, since that is unfortunately the way we're handling it right now. It's all right there in one location where the child feels safe and where the parents feel supported. I think that would be pretty easy to do, actually, and so much less expensive than continuing to send children to prison. You know, in the state of California, I think when I was researching it, the cost to put a child in jail for a year is close to $200,000 a year per child, and they spend less than $9,000 a year on education. It's just the priorities are baffling to me.
Well, how are we doing when it comes to funding for mental health issues and research?
Oh, there's not enough funding. I mean, Tom Insel, the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, he's a rock star, in my opinion. He's really all over this. Brain research is really taking off, but we're still funding mental health research at pretty low levels. I mean, I watched the cancer documentary on PBS recently, and I was really struck by how just one very wealthy donor was able to attack that problem and completely change the world in terms of cancer care. I really want to see the same thing with mental illness. You know, I think it was Ted Stanley who just made a huge donation, $650 million or something, and we need more of that. We've just got to throw the money into research. We saw that it paid off with cancer, and I think we would see the same thing with mental health.
Is part of the problem with the issue that there's a stigma surrounding mental health?
Oh, yeah. Stigma is huge. You know, and self-stigma.
The stigma is still alive, I take it. I think those were words used at one point.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, and again, look back to cancer. At one point, cancer was stigmatized, right? And so I think we're doing a better job as a society now at talking about mental illness. In fact, with the German Wings tragedy, all of us were just kind of really afraid of what would happen with the media reporting on that. And I thought, you know, in general, the media reporting on the pilot's mental illness was very respectful and very restrained, which is a good thing. We need more of that. But the stigma is still very much alive. And I think the challenge is that as long as some people continue to think mental illness is a choice or a character flaw, or as long as we keep saying behavioral health, you know, as if these are choices, these behaviors are choices instead of symptoms of a brain disease, we're going to continue to see stigma. And we see it in all kinds of subtle ways. You know, there's a BMW car commercial right now, for example. I don't know if you've seen it, where they pull up to a hotel and it's like, oh, that woman looks crazy. Let's get out of here. I mean, really? You know, like, so is stigma alive? Yeah. Stigma is very much alive.
You say we're doing a little bit better with how we deal with the stigma. Are you seeing any other progress in how mental illness is dealt with in this country?
You know, the biggest challenge for me and for a lot of advocates is that we're 2 years after Newtown, and no, we're not 2 years better. You know, it's like we had this opportunity to really push for change, and nothing happened. You know, nothing happened. And again, the more what a lot of us are seeing is really just police shootings of people with mental illness, things like that. You know, again, as long as we continue to focus on treating mental illness, and I'm using air quotes here when I say treat, by sending people to prison or by making it a crime to have mental illness, it's going to be really hard for us to shift and move back toward, you know, the wonderful things that happen with cancer, with funding, with the end of stigma, with new research, with new treatments. So, you know, on the one hand, I'm excited about the brain research, like that we're seeing. But on the other hand, you know, boots on the ground in the community, families are still struggling, and they're still trying to get access to care that just isn't there.
So what's the big message that you hope people will get from reading your book, The Price of Silence?
I think the biggest message I want people to take away is that parents are not alone in this fight, and that the fight is worth it. Your child is worth it. Every child deserves a chance to have a happy, productive life. Every child in our society. And so that's really the message I want to share. It's one of hope and help. And as we come together and as we demand change, as we speak up for our kids, I know that we can solve this problem, that's crisis, this public health crisis in our society. We can do it, but it's going to take parents and kids speaking up and demanding change.
Liza, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time.
Liza Long is the author of The Price of Silence, A Mom's Perspective on Mental Illness. Her blog is The Anarchist Soccer Mom, where she first published her 2012 essay, I Am Adam Lanza's Mother.